in paradise. Come, Kate, and we'll to bed. Ha, 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 ha. A pox upon the life that late I led.
For now I shall ever be mine.
Kiss Me Kate on Big Band, Broadway, and more here. WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. And it is 1 o'clock on Friday, and it's now time for a public affairs show, the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal for Friday, December 3rd. Yes, here we are in December, Michigan winter, freezing out there, but not as bad today as yesterday. Anyway, how about the local news and those alternative views? That's what you tune into the show for, or maybe you're listening to our podcast, and we are here to give you that update. We're expecting a special guest to come in the studio in a few minutes, but until then, I have our WHFR news team here in the studio with me. Amy Powers, our WHFR news director, and Dennis Reimar is a host of Campus Connection, another forum talk show news show on this channel, as well as our promotions coordinator for this semester, as well as the editor of the Mirror newspaper, and the new edition is now out here on campus, so that's very exciting. Welcome, Amy and Dennis.
Well, thank you. Dennis's resume basically takes up the hour. It was nice to be here.
Just keep going. What about Fine Citizen? Former Boy Scout, isn't there any? No?
A credit to your gender.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, as we're waiting for our special guest to arrive on campus here, I'd like, but since both of you did attend, and I was not able to attend, and I missed a lot of good food, I guess, the fourth sustainability meeting here in Dearborn took place. This is organized by the Sierra Club Cool Cities Initiative program, and this week on Wednesday night, the 1st of December, they had a food and climate change topic, how the two are interrelated, and in fact it was a potluck sort of thing, so bring your own sustainable foods, I guess. And did the food sustain you guys?
It did. How do you feel about that?
It was very filling.
Okay, well, that's all that matters here. Hopefully nutritious, too. There was also, of course, a lecture presentation by Professor Lourdes Lohr. Is that the tell us about the content there and what you learned as we're waiting for our guest to arrive. Climate change, a crisis on your plate.
Well, she had a lengthy presentation that she really condensed, because this is what she presented is part of a she also presents during lectures here on campus, and basically how food is produced, or, you know, that basically how much what it takes to for 1 pound of beef to get to the table.
That's a great example.
And it's It's not only that. There was
So it's a matter
of
there.
Sorry, I'm rambling.
It's obviously a matter of the energy that goes into raising food, and in fact, the negative effects on the environment
too. Greenhouse gases.
The greenhouse gases, the emissions. I mean, if you use a lot of tractors on your farm, even if they're robot-driven tractors, in order to irrigate or dig up weeds or harvest the crops, then those tractors, if they're powered by gasoline engines or diesel engines, there's emissions that come from that. So if you look at the total picture, no doubt, it's kind of scary. And especially, I don't know if she got into some of the animal cruelty issues, too.
Well, the CAFOs, the confined animal feeding operations, she did, and she spoke at length about...
She did. She had a Google map of some of them, and there are a lot of them in the Jackson area.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of the things, right from her information, from Lourdes Lohr, she said the issue is that our food system is a major consumer of fossil fuels, 19% of the nation's energy use, more than any other sector of the economy. It's also a major emitter of greenhouse gases and a major cause of concern for our health. Do you remember Ms. Lohr saying, Professor Lohr saying that, in fact, to get 1 pound of beef in our kitchen, it uses more water than the average person uses
like
to bathe
5,000 gallons
in a year.
Had a lot of visuals up there.
Well, that's the thing is that, Jay, you know a lot of these things. This was kind of new to me. And these are things that you've been following for a long time, and it's kind of new to me. So I was sufficiently shocked and appropriately grossed out.
Yeah, I've seen a number of feature-length documentaries on the issue of food, food production, and the environment in general. I highly recommend people over Christmas don't just watch animated features all the time. Maybe you want to rent something like Food Incorporated, which is a great documentary that talks about these very issues. And unfortunately, if you actually it might mean that you're going to change your diet. You're going to change the kind of food that you choose to eat either at home or in restaurants or both venues because of the exploitation of the environment and of the animals. And it really makes you conscious of the food chain as well as the impact on the environment. Now, scientists, I don't think that Professor Lohr had to spend much time convincing the group that attended that climate change is real and it's human-caused and it's happening faster than we want it to. And there's going to be significant weather consequences, a rise in global temperatures, and a lot of other problems. For example, a lot of food sources will be eliminated because of the increase of arid, that is, desert-like areas around the world. And that's happening faster than we can believe. So even though it seems like we got plenty of food here in the U.S., the way we raise it is a very negative sort of thing. And we can make tremendous changes. And I think at all these sustainability meetings, even though I haven't made it to any of them, from what you folks tell me and what I read in the papers, if all of us could make some small changes, either in, let's say, the kind of car we drive or the way we transport ourselves, like choose to walk or even ride the bus or bike or whatever we can do instead of a car, even maybe just one day a week, if we can change, for example, the amount of meat we eat every day to less, or maybe take one day a week off, don't eat any meat. Keep those fruits and veggies coming in, though, folks. And of course, they probably talked about eating local as much as possible.
Oh, man.
Food produced
in
the real emphasis on eating local and making sure that what you're purchasing local are from the local farmers. They're not from these CAMFO farms.
CAFO. Were you stunned as me when you found out that when they don't have enough cherries in Traverse City for their cherry festival, they import them from Washington State?
Yeah.
Wasn't that kind of interesting?
Yeah.
Did you know this?
I heard about that. We don't like to talk about that in terms of Michigan tourism.
No, of course not. But I mean, that's
the reality.
It's reality.
When you go to the stores and you see the labels on some of the food and fruits and vegetables, I mean, they look like they're ripe enough and maybe safe to eat. How can you tell by looking at them? And the label says it comes from Chile or it comes from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? You just have to. It doesn't take much to imagine the amount of energy that is gasoline, diesel-powered trucks, boats, whatever, to get it here. I mean, some of this is coming 8,000, 10,000 miles to be in our local stores, and that's just got to be wrong. It's got to be the wrong thing to do for the environment. Local farmers, for a variety of reasons, small farm operations, which are more independent, the odds are their food, even if it's not certified organic, is going to be less contaminated by unknown chemicals, and maybe they won't be using genetically modified crops.
They don't have to. It doesn't.
No, they don't have to.
Is your point because it's so quick from harvest to plate? You're exactly right.
And if you are truly an organic farmer, whether you're certified or not, you know ways that nature will help you to grow those crops. You can use natural fertilizers and ways to eliminate bugs and pests. Okay, you have a higher percent of spoilage.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the bugs still get to a higher percent of your crop, but still it's local and it's fresher. It has to be fresher. Think about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just ate bananas this morning that came from Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
and Jamaican bananas, and it was they didn't even taste ripe. And I'm thinking, how can it come all the way from Jamaica and it's still sort of too solid and crunchy? You ever had a crunchy banana?
Yeah, that's kind of weird.
Well, right, because they expect that it's going to take a long time. Now, maybe they kept it in a freezer somewhere. I don't know how they ship them.
So 1,500 miles. Every item on your plate.
It's not like mm-hmm. they flew it from Jamaica overnight to mm-mm. get to Dearborn.
Right. No,
you know,
that wouldn't be cost-effective. You're right. No.
So if you think about this, of course, it causes trouble in your head. But, I think a lot of people should just be made aware. And what department is Professor Lohr in here?
She actually teaches nutrition at the college. But she was the advisor to the Student Environmental Association along with Mr. Seacrest until this year.
Right. That's really the issue, is that if you eat food that is the most nutritious for you, the most healthy, that produces the greatest amount of health for you, you're not going to be buying a lot of this food that comes from far distances. You're not going to be buying even the soft drinks, the empty calorie, either diet or sugar beverages. I mean, when I walk into a store, and I've almost been a vegetarian, let's say 5 days out of each week, not eating meat and trying to eat local, and it is a struggle because there's always a fast food restaurant temptation because of advertising. I mean, the food always looks better on TV than it does actually when you're eating it, but you try to remember the image of the great food as you're eating what is actually in front of you.
As you look at it.
Yeah. I have to forget if it's a hamburger, and I rarely eat hamburgers now because I know about the cattle and their situation, or the pigs or the chickens or the turkeys. These factory farms are not kind to these animals or these creatures. They breed them, they debilitate them, they mutate them for the sake of profit. And it is just, if you have any compassion for other people, you might have compassion for the cruelty to these animals. You have to assume it's cruel when you see how they have to live.
Yeah, and she had pointed out they live a much shorter lifespan. It may be, 7 months as opposed to, years on a...
3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
on a free range. Farm. Exactly. Yeah. And, it's just so many things we learn. We learn that cattle are not supposed to eat soy and grain. They're supposed to eat grass. There's a lot of different things, and when they do these things, obviously things are passed along to the people that consume the animals. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just any way you look, I have to tell you, I get it now, and meat is not as appetizing to me.
So what are we going to do, folks?
Well, you can start by eating less meat. These are some of the pointers.
You took notes.
Eating less meat and dairy, just as you had said, Jay. Put a few more vegetables on the plate. Buy more locally. She had just emphasized, get cooking. I mean, there's so much waste in what we buy and
every
and throw
day.
Away.
Do you know that every day what Americans waste in food could fill the Rose Bowl? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Hundred billion pounds is wasted.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I found a good, and there's so many cookbooks out there, but I found, I guess on the internet, a student vegetarian cookbook.
Huh.
And the reason it was written for students is to give them very simple, quick ways to eat vegetarian, non-meat dishes that would be healthy and so on. And I've actually gotten a few valuable recipes out of that because I don't like to spend hours, although that would produce maybe more delicious meals. But it that's really been helpful. I probably should comment here, and again, our guest is expected any second out front if they can find the campus. just south, if you're listening, special guest, we're just south of Ford Road, Evergreen. If you get to Fairlane Town Center, turn around and come back. You went too far. And we're not University of Michigan Dearborn, so don't wait too long to turn in here. But we're right.
I think she's well aware.
Right at the front. Right at the front. But
she's not listening anyway.
Dennis and I talked last week about Panera Cares, and that was a story in all the papers.
Fantastic.
And that's how Panera Bread on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, only this one location, is now operating as a nonprofit foundation. Part of Panera, but it's a foundation within the Panera operation that is nonprofit, and they give back their profits to the community in grants or just for local projects of one sort or another. And they, very simply, they allow you to eat at whatever and pay whatever you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can pay the list price on the menu, that's great. They'll have their usual profit margins coming in. If you give more, like you round up the dollar or something, they'll put the extra into the foundation grant money also. And, of course, we can plug them because it's a nonprofit, but it's a great idea. Maybe it'll catch on. Obviously, if too many people eat there for less or no cost, then they'll go broke. Even as a nonprofit, you have to make some money to justify the operation.
Well, I was just going to say, and that's a big part of the reason why it's in Dearborn, because I've talked to a lot of people about this. A surprising number of people weren't even aware, even with it in the paper, you know, talking about it on the show, and they said, why Dearborn? Dearborn's not a low-income city or whatever. I'm like, well, that's kind of the point. You put it in someplace because if it's into low-income area, for whatever reason, unfortunately, they may not have enough people that can afford to sustain it. So this way, they're hoping that there's like that, I think we refer to it as, the balance, where ultimately some people will pay a little bit more, some people a little bit less.
And if you've eaten at Panera, I mentioned last week, Consumer Reports says that their salads are some of the healthiest, low in calorie, low in fat, delicious tasting. I had one of their panini sandwiches. And, of course, you realize sandwiches at most small restaurants, maybe not fast food places where they have that dollar burger or something, but they're about $6, $7, $8 for the sandwich on a plate, with a pickle or whatever on the side, and that's what Panera prices are like, $6, $7, $8. If you can afford that, at Panera Cares on Michigan Avenue in West Dearborn, you can pay less. And what I saw there, besides the food was good, it was fine. My colleagues from WHFR, Laura and Susan, our other management folks here, were with me, and they even chose to eat some of the pastries.
Did they really? That surprises me.
Little desserts. Sure it does.
Hope they're not listening.
I treated them to it, too, so they deserve it. But we found the food very good, just like you would expect at Panera, and they have gotten great reviews from healthy eating recommendations from like Consumer Reports and other newsletters and so on. And what I saw was interesting. It was very crowded. Of course, it was about 5 o'clock, some people's dinner time, but they had laptops and student type people behind them almost everywhere. Now, of course, West Dearborn, good for the merchants there, they decided to make it all a Wi-Fi free zone. So if you have a laptop or iPhone or iPod Touch, you can use that Wi-Fi connection to surf the internet, do homework, schoolwork. So they look like they're in their early to late 20s, maybe somewhere in high school, but they were everywhere. So I don't know if they're paying full price or not, whether they were taking advantage of the fact they could eat for just a couple bucks instead of seven or eight.
Right.
But they were doing great business anyway, and it certainly was a place where a lot of people were meeting and doing homework, doing research, it looked like. Didn't see any scandalous pictures on any of the screens.
You didn't?
So I think they're actually quite serious at doing stuff. And there weren't a lot of people that looked like they were like rich or super rich. I mean, again, student types, college age, typical college age, which would be early
20s. We rich people don't like to really broadcast it, you know. I mean, if you look at
people that can afford to pay retail price, you're talking about, yes. And there's not that many, even the... The middle-class tax cut didn't go through this week in our lame duck session in Washington, D.C. Those Republicans holding out for the continuation
for their constituents.
Of rich people. This is people over $250,000 a year. They deserve to get that tax break. that Bush gave them, which they didn't have before that.
Extended permanently.
Yes, of course, because it all trickles down, doesn't it? I'm still waiting for that that trickling. but George Bush the First even called Ronald Reagan's idea of trickle down. He said that's voodoo economics.
I remember that phrase. I didn't know it was attributed to
The original George Bush. He knew, and most economists, except a few conservative economists, most economists would agree that that the rich are getting richer and they're not giving it back, whether it's the tax situation or hiring more employees, like unemployment rates for the nation. By the way, all opinions on this show are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, although we hope so. But it's been the best year ever for business in this country. Any business that still exists is making profits better than like for the last 10 years. So go figure that. But are they hiring more employees?
No, because they need more a couple more years of this type of business before they can hire.
Or to be safe, so they can maintain the CEO salaries. We've got some commentaries here from Jim Hightower about this. And keep those profit margins up for the shareholders, which are not the average people, by the way, not the majority of people in the country. So it's really totally ironic. The jobless rate is creeping up even more, and businesses and CEO salaries are the highest ever, including Wall Street salaries and bonuses, highest ever. What have they done? What have they trickled down is really the key issue for me. If you're going to keep getting tax breaks and tax cuts at the highest levels, what have they done lately? To coin a phrase from Janet Jackson's song from many decades ago, for the American public. I mean, for the country, for the good of the country. They can survive, I guess, just fine, but it doesn't, I don't see that trickle effect. Sure, they want to make sure that their profits are very secure before they reinvest in their companies. Well, that's just crazy. That's unpatriotic, un-American, and you shouldn't support companies that are like that if you know of any. That's my personal opinion, of course, in this holiday season.
We talk about no trickle down. There's a young lady that we work with at the newspaper, and no names or anything. She works for a pretty big retail company, and not surprisingly, many of their sales this season, they're doing very well as a company this time of year. Most of their sales are coming from online purchases. Well, they don't reward the employees. What I understand, they're separate accounting. So even though the company is doing better than it has in past years, since the online sales, they're not giving bonuses. They're not giving. Isn't that an interesting dynamic?
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah, where'd the money come from?
It's an excuse.
Oh, absolutely. Anyway. Yeah.
It's an excuse.
Interesting dynamic was kind of a...
They feel that if the employees see less people and less money coming into the cash register, that they will accept the fact that a few of them have to work fewer hours or they won't get a bonus at Christmas.
You're exactly right.
More hours. And in fact, the company is doing just fine, and they should keep those people able to eat healthy. Let's switch topics to a couple of things in the paper here. Again, we hope our guests can find Henry Ford Community College. Last time I tried, last Friday, I came here at the last minute at 12:30-ish, and I found the holiday traffic. Of course, it was Cyber Monday or whatever. No, Cyber Friday. Well, anyway.
Black Friday?
That should have been traffic in your home.
The Christmas rush around Fairlane was awful. Now, today I came in an hour early, and I didn't notice that, but maybe it was just lunch, people out for lunch or whatever.
Yeah, so a lot of people had last Friday off.
Around here. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Duh. Of course, yeah. Anyway,
we didn't.
A few special events, and at this time of year, we're short of news. No, we're not.
But whatever we don't know, we make up.
Dearborn Youth Symphony season premiere is this Sunday. So you're like, well, a premiere, that happens in September. No, it's going to be this Sunday, 4 p.m., December 5th, Michael A. Guido Theater at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center. And that should be a lot of fun, and it's going to include performances by the combined flute choirs, concert orchestra, and the symphony orchestra. And so it won't be exclusively a Christmas production, but I bet there'll be some decorations up, you know. So I think that could be a great thing to do with the family in the holiday season. I should also mention that The Secret Garden, the play here at Henry Ford Community College, the theater for young audiences in our drama department, always doing stellar presentations. This is their last weekend of shows, And it'll be tonight at 7 p.m., Saturday, tomorrow at 2 and 7 p.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. only. Ticket prices here at our auditorium, Adre Auditorium, Mackenzie Fine Arts Center, Henry Ford Community College, main campus, are adults $12, students with ID $10, children 12 and under $6. And the Youth Symphony prices over at the center on Michigan Avenue, east of Greenfield, are $10 for adults and $8 for children and seniors. So that's at 4 p.m. Yes, 4 p.m. Sunday, December 5th at the center and
so
Secret Garden here.
So your whole weekend can be filled up.
Absolutely. Keep the
for
family
your weekend planning guide.
Going out if you can afford it. It really, I think, will help your spirits, and actually doing things in a group is a good thing. Maybe other times of year you might not think about spending time with one another in your family and or with friends. And these are great things. A theater for young people, the Secret Garden, HFCC, and the Dearborn Youth Symphony. And, you know, we actually did a small benefit 1 year, and we invited three members of the Youth Symphony, young people, to play. And wow, what spirit, what excitement, and what virtuosity, too.
I was going to say, a real level of
just because they're
maturity.
Young doesn't mean that they can't play well. Mm-hmm. You know, not in this case. The Dearborn Symphony Youth Orchestra, it really has pretty high quality. It was very entertaining, and they played their hearts out, and I just hope they have some hearts left over still, because they do a fantastic job.
Well, there's a bit of a gap with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra still on strike, so
yes.
There's a way to get your orchestra fixed.
Yeah, there's just the Detroit Symphony Civic Orchestra, which somehow legally they can do this. They're performing around town in Christmas concerts. Like, they'll be at the center, I think, tonight and tomorrow, doing the music portion for the Nutcracker. There's a presentation of the Nutcracker with some New York City ballet group.
Okay.
It's touring, but it's going to be the Detroit Symphony Civic Orchestra performing the music for them.
So that's a select number of Detroit Symphony Orchestra members?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Are they union or non-union?
Okay.
Does the union allow them to perform
all
with
right.
civic orchestras
okay.
in order to keep some money coming in while they're on strike? But in any event, that's always a tradition in Dearborn. There's always a performance by someone of the Nutcracker. And this time it's a professional ballet troupe, touring troupe from New York City. So should be a very good performance to consider, too. But not as local or community oriented, except for the Detroit Symphony people, I guess. Okay, looking at the local news now. Sure, there's news. Of course there is. In Dearborn follow-up here, Dennis has left to watch for our guest and get them in the studio as quickly as possible here. Civil Service Commission wrangling continues, and this is in the Wednesday edition of the Dearborn Press and Guide, December 1st. J. Patrick Pepper reports that the bitter infighting on the city's Civil Service Commission continued during a recent regularly scheduled meeting. Now, this is a meeting back on November 18th. It was going to decide whether to fire City Human Resources Director Valerie Murphy Goodrich, but instead, the meeting refocused scrutiny on Commissioner Margaret Schaefer's political activities. I don't want to go into the ugly details here, but it's amazing that an appointed commission for the city that's supposed to be above politics and just help decide, you know, hiring questions, ethics questions to a certain extent, and also salaries, can be so embroiled in this, and it goes on for months. And now, of course, there's a lawsuit by Morris Goodman, lawyer, on behalf, well, not directly, but indirectly, would affect Marge Powell's situation. She was last reappointed by, was it Mayor O'Reilly, or the commission actually voted her to be appointed again in 2009, but she never took her oath, which violates the city charter and led to her commission seat being vacated. And so that interpretation is now going to court. And the city council has not really come in on this. So the squabbling goes on. This is just unconscionable that this little stuff happens, but maybe it doesn't really matter. Just let them bicker. I don't know.
It does matter. It's, you know, it's taking the focus away from the job at hand, and all this side bickering, and it certainly seems like there are certain procedures that are in place for taking the oath and moving, straightforward into office. And
well, I know the issue about Margaret Schaefer and her political activities. Supposedly, if you're in a political position, you can't be on the commission. Well, she is simply like a neighborhood representative. What do they call them for the Democratic Party? You know, you're an elected representative from your neighborhood.
Okay.
You're a party official, but you're not in office.
Right, right.
Well, that's why they want to kick her off. Because she got elected as a local delegate or a local representative. It's an official thing. You get to vote officially. Mm-hmm. But you're not serving the public directly. It's just within the party. It's internal.
Right.
And that's why they want to kick her off. I know what those people do. Okay, she is definitely part of that political party, and she's, you know, in on the decision-making. But her decisions are not affecting anybody directly through an elected representative. So I don't think that should have happened, but I'm not on the commission. Who knows how they see it? They're just taking a very strict interpretation, of course. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, that's not friendly. Let's see here. Also in the press and guide, we were talking about Christmas things, so we're going back and forth here. Greenfield Village. Another nonprofit in our area, you know, you may not remember, they're all decorated and ready to greet you. It's called Holiday Nights. It runs December 4th, and then the 10th and 11th. That's tomorrow, the 4th, wow. And then the 10th and 11th, and the 17th through 23rd, and 26th through 27th, from 6:30 to 10 p.m. Normally, the village is closed in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's open during the day, of course. You can go there, I think, every day but Christmas and have a daytime visit to Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village. You really should buy a pass if you live in Dearborn and go frequently. You don't have to think about the cost. It's very reasonable to get a family group pass. It's $80, $100, maybe $120 if it's unlimited kids or I don't know. But the passes are very reasonable. You can go back. You can walk just for exercise. You can look at the different exhibits all year long. But Holiday Nights does charge an extra price. Oh, my gosh. $37 for adult members. And $28.25 for youth members aged 5 to 12. But there's so much they include. It's like you get rides around the village, and you can listen to performances of music, and there's band serenades, and there's food stations. And obviously, they give you roasted hot chestnuts and hot apple cider and cocoa and a hand-carved roast beef in one place and warm winter fruit compote with sweetened cream. I'm getting hungry here. And so it's a great sort of 19th, early 20th century mm-hmm. kind of Christmas festivities if you can afford it. And, of course, it's for a nonprofit organization that's really helping to preserve these great traditions and this kind of fun. So if you can afford it, you might consider Holiday Nights at Greenfield Village. You can go to their website, thehenryford.org, I think it is.
And I think when it gets maybe just a little bit chillier, they've got ice skating there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know,
yes,
it's a really family fun night.
And firework finale in the crisp winter sky.
Okay.
So I don't live far from the village. I always wonder what all those explosions are late at night during the Christmas season.
It's okay to come out.
And that's them. That's them doing it. Yeah, it's all healthy. It's not a terrorist act.
Bad Henry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't call Homeland Security on them. And all kinds of things are going on. And it's in the paper from Wednesday, December 1st. And the first evening is tomorrow night, actually, for this very special evening activity.
And it should be a nice night.
Well, of course. Things like that are going on. Dearborn Curbside Yard Waste Collection. If you've got that waste, folks, and who doesn't, it's extended this year to December 17th. Originally, we're talking about leaves, folks. Loose leaf collection that is picked up curbside.
Okay.
By little scoops and men with shovels and big trucks in some cases.
So you can rake it right out to in front of your curb?
Yes. Dearborn is unique in that you don't necessarily, although you can still put it in barrels or in bags, and they'll take that. But the yard waste, including leaves, can be in proper containers on trash day through the week of December 13th through 17th. As well as curbside collection, okay. And then it doesn't start up again, so you have to store your trash until sometime next spring. I don't have the date here, but...
Or really do some composting.
Yeah, right. You may be forced to do that. Also, you know, public service days in Dearborn. Again, we're kind of unique in this, and that's the same day as trash is picked up each week. Okay, that enforcement, which means you can't have your cars on the street while they're trying to pick up the trash, which makes sense.
Sure.
But other than picking up the trash, they also can clean the streets or pick up leaves or other things if the cars aren't there. So it's a regulation in Dearborn to keep your cars off the street, in your driveway, in your garage, or whatever during those days. Well, that will end for the season December 3rd and begin again on April 4th. So for the next couple of months, friends, family, they can park on the streets any day of the week if they're coming over. This is after December 3rd. Yes, that's today.
Alrighty. That's right. All day, yes. As they say.
Mm-hmm. And then, looking at the Dearborn Times-Herald for this week, and I think we've been reporting on this, teachers in Dearborn, Dearborn Federation of Teachers Union, are protesting. They meet in front of Board of Ed meetings. The last time they were out in droves, it says here in the paper. Droves. November 22nd for a rally before Dearborn Public Schools Board of Ed meeting. I don't know how much a drove is. I haven't.
It's a lot. It's a whole lot.
I drove my car yesterday, but I don't know how many people are in a drove. But it seems like a couple dozen at least. And teachers, they say, just to remind you folks, in Dearborn, they're operating under their third step freeze in the past 4 years, a measure that saves the district about $3.2 million each time annual step raises are withheld. And they thought they were at an agreement, and now the Dearborn Public Schools Administration have gone to the next stage of bringing in outside arbiters in this. Just, I think, to delay the process. I mean, I think they know how much money they've got. They have money to give people an amount of raise, finally, after all these years. I think our teachers deserve that. We have good teachers locally. And so we're going to now go to Jim Hightower for his commentaries on today's show, the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. So stay tuned for more news and information.
You think you've got financial problems, Bucko? It's time you consider squeeze that others are feeling. For example, CEOs. Yeah, they're paid a bundle, but that comes with its own problems, such as tax bills to pay, country club dues to cover, and security costs to protect CEOs from riffraff like you. Who do you think shells out for these expenses, Bucko? Well, a group named 24/7 Wall Street has probed into that question. Sure enough, even the most fabulously paid CEOs treat these personal expenses as perks to be paid not by them, but by shareholders. For example, Occidental Petroleum chieftain Ray Irani's paycheck was more than $30 million last year. To dodge all the taxes he owed on that, Ray incurred $390,000 in accounting and legal fees. No problem, though. He just passed the bill to Oxy's shareholders. Another pricey problem for corporate high flyers is transportation. You might have trouble getting your employer even to pay for the gas you use on company business, but then you're not Michael Jeffries, boss of Abercrombie & Fitch. He was paid a handsome $38 million last year, but he still billed the Tony Haberdasher $639,000 for his personal use of the corporate airplane. How about executive bodyguards? Oracle's top dog, Larry Ellison, is a high-techer who keeps downsizing and offshoring his workforce, even as he upsizes his own take. Last year, he upsized to an eye-popping $84 million in pay, the highest of any CEO. Perhaps feeling a bit vulnerable, Larry got Oracle to pay $1.4 million for a security detail to protect him. This is Jim Hightower saying, all of us get to help pay for such executive perks since the corporations pass along these expenses to us taxpayers. To learn more, go to 247wallstreet.com.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Here's a crime drama, tragedy, and farce, all in one play. First comes the perpetrator, Martin Erzinger. A well-heeled wealth manager in Morgan Stanley Smith Barney's Denver office, Erzinger handles more than $1 billion in private assets and describes himself as, quote, dedicated to ultra-high net worth individuals. Now, Dr. Stephen Milo comes on stage, and the drama quickly turns to tragedy. Milo, a surgeon and father of two, was bicycling in Colorado last July when, wham, he was struck from behind by Erzinger. Instead of stopping to render aid, the money man sped away in his Mercedes-Benz. But his car was damaged by the crash, so he finally had to pull over and call the Mercedes service center to have it towed. But he didn't ask for an ambulance to check on the poor guy he had just run over. As Dr. Milo later noted, Erzinger struck me, fled, and left me for dead. The doctor did survive, but he suffered spinal cord injuries, bleeding from his brain, knee damage, and disabling spinal headaches. He faces multiple surgeries, plastic surgery, and lifetime pain. Next, District Attorney Mark Hurlburt enters from stage right, and high tragedy devolves into low farce. The DA announced that he was dropping felony charges against Erzinger, instead only citing him for two misdemeanor traffic violations. Why? Because Erzinger is rich. Noting that this money handler could lose his prestigious Morgan Stanley position, the compassionate DA said, "Felony convictions have some pretty serious job implications for someone in Mr. Erzinger's profession, and that entered into my decision." This is Jim Hightower saying, "Wow, what a humanitarian! I'm guessing that a felony conviction also would have some pretty serious job implications for any low-wage working stiff who nearly killed someone, though I doubt the DA would give a damn in that case."
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views. Our special guest has arrived, and we have a traffic report. I-94 is closed in this area. Oh, my gosh. East-west I-94.
Just west. Just 94 west.
Oh, okay. 94
from
west.
Detroit
so,
to Dearborn.
So if anyone else is coming from Wayne State, as our guest has done, area, it's going to be slow going. Sorry about that. I was making a joke about maybe it's the holiday shoppers coming to Fairlane Town Center, but there's still some places to shop in Detroit, right?
There are many, yes.
Okay. Our guest is Jocelyn Benson. Jocelyn ran for the Secretary of State's position in the November 2nd election. She was on the Democratic ticket. She was part of the Democratic Party, and she lost. But I've got to say, and Jocelyn, you did very well in losing. You were the highest vote-getter of all the statewide Democrats. You had more actual votes than Virge Bonaro for governor, more votes and a higher percentage, too, of votes within your race than David Layton for Attorney General, too. So somehow you got the attention of a lot of people, whether there was independents or Republicans, and although you lost to Ruth Johnson, who did have name recognition certainly among Republicans. She was the lieutenant governor on the last ticket of with Mr. DeVos, who ran for governor as Republican and lost, and she's been the clerk, I guess, in Oakland County for a number of years. And so Oakland County people knew of her and had supported her in that office, which the county clerk handles elections there, too, so she had some knowledge about this. But congratulations on that, on those numbers. I happen to know from your background, and I should let my our listeners know very briefly that we have someone who, as a candidate for the office of Secretary of State, really knows election law and really knows about Secretary of State's in our states here in the United States, that you've actually, as I said, you've actually written the book on state secretary of state, which was just published this year. A little bit of a pricey edition. You have it with you there. Something probably you hope that a lot of maybe college libraries will pick up, certainly.
Sure, yeah, certainly.
You know, but your background, amazing academic credentials. As a college professor myself, I wish I was this smart, that you graduated magna cum laude, which is pretty high up there, from Wesley College. That's in Massachusetts?
Yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. And while you were there, you founded an annual event, Women in American Political Action Activism Conference. And so it sounds like you were involved in politics a lot while you were there. You even got elected to serve in the governing body for the town of Wesley,
mm-hmm.
Massachusetts.
Yes.
Is that like a city council?
Yeah, it's essentially like the city council for the town, and there was no student representation or voice at the time, and so
Fantastic.
I ran to create that voice.
So you really believe, unlike a lot of people out there today, I'm sorry to say, that there is both a need and almost a necessity to be part of the political system.
Certainly. I mean, so many decisions are made every day that affect so many people, from not just taxes and education, but health care and how various services from licenses to roads and other things are administered. So it's critical. And the great thing about our country is that citizens have a legal right and a protection to decide who runs our government and what the decisions are and hold those people accountable. And it's a great and beautiful thing. And I was proud to have dedicated my career to and still have to protecting the right to vote for all citizens.
And just to finish your academic credentials, but there's plenty more here that I'm not going to read that I should. You have a master's in sociology after your degree from Wesley, and that was done at Oxford in United Kingdom, in England, Oxford University, Magdalen College, is that a...
Mm-hmm. Maudlin.
Maudlin.
Yes.
Oh, they always pronounce things differently in England. Okay. But it's not a maudlin topic. Okay.
Oh, there you go.
M-A-U-D-L-A-N. Oh, no. And then I came back, and after some nonprofit work, actually, or for some nonprofit organizations, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and even worked with National Public Radio for a while as a legal assistant to Nina mm-hmm. Totenberg. So you know public radio.
Yes, it was a great time there.
Yeah, and then Harvard University Law School is where you got your law degree, which is not an easy place to study and must have been great, the sort of level of competition and the active minds all around you. And general editor of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. Unbelievable. But you're putting all this to practice. And
yeah.
It's fantastic, both down at law school, teaching classes there starting again in January, I understand. And, of course, is this your first, other than the Wesley election, is this your first time back in politics, running for office here in Michigan?
It was. And I was very, very intentional in my campaign to emphasize that I wasn't running to run for office, but running because I wanted to run the Secretary of State's office. And it's an office that is really, I think, should and can be a watchdog on politics as usual, on the traditional political process. And so if you look around the country where the most effective secretaries of state are, Democrats and Republicans, there are secretaries of state who aren't from the very political culture that they need to enforce election law to regulate. It's people who are outsiders who often have the most successes as secretaries of state. So I felt I was uniquely positioned with the knowledge of the law that the Secretary of State enforces to play that role. And I certainly hold the office in great deference. I think it's a great place to work on these issues, but there are many ways to work on these issues.
Well, I haven't read your book yet. It is. It looks like it would be an accessible read rather than a heavy, deep legal document. I'm sure you've got your sources, but you did interviews with a lot of the current secretaries of state throughout the United States, and asked them on a variety of issues. I did get the preface. Apparently, don't charge for that online. And also the table of contents. And so there's many aspects to the Secretary of State's office that I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't think about. I mean, most of us think about it only in terms of driver licenses and license plates. That's horrendous if you have to stand in line at the Secretary of State's office locally, since several offices have been closed, although there's great ways to do it online if you have that capability now. But the most important issues have to do with voting. Of course, everybody who does vote would like to be guaranteed that their votes will be counted accurately. And if questions come up, they'll be handled fairly, not necessarily politically, and of course nationally. And I think one reason you wanted to do this was because of the questions about secretaries of state in the year 2000 and 2004 elections. Also, I guess in 2006 there were some issues that came up. And you've been an advisor, actually a hired consultant. I love this. Hired a consultant with the Democratic Party too, trying to work out some of these issues and develop plans for the future. So you've been heavily involved. So election reform and voter education are some key things that most people don't normally think about in the Secretary of State's office. They just see it as sort of a functionary thing. You just, manage the office and make sure people show up on time. And you actually had in your campaign stated some reforms you felt were important maybe in Michigan. Could you want to comment on some of those? I'm not sure that Ruth Johnson will go ahead with it, but what did you see in Michigan that maybe could be done better at the Secretary of State level?
Well, we really need to modernize a lot of things in Michigan in various ways, and I think the three for me that are most critical are, one, making sure that we have enough transparency and disclosure in our campaign finance system. You know, who's putting money into politics, and who's actually paying for the ads that we see on TV, and really pushing for more disclosure, transparency. When we get those annoying robocalls, we should know who's paying for them. And the Secretary of State is uniquely poised to push for those reforms. So campaign finance reform issues are number one. Number two is improving customer service, addressing those long lines by taking innovations from other states, like allowing people to make an appointment ahead of time, which was a real big thing that I'd like to see in the Secretary of State's office, so that you can call ahead, make an appointment, and skip the wait. And then, in addition to campaign finance reform, customer service, modernizing our system of elections so that we're brought up to speed with other states, allowing citizens to register to vote online and update their profile that way, like they have in many other states. That also helps members serving abroad in the military to ensure that they're registered to vote if they can register online. Also ensuring we have audits of our election machines so that they're counting our ballots accurately. And when we talk about a close election on election night where we see a couple votes make a difference, we really see how important it is to have an election administration system that protects every vote. And those are votes that people fought and died to protect, and so we need to have a Secretary of State who's not going to play politics with the office, but who instead is going to make sure that the office runs well for our citizens.
In some of the races here in the Dearborn area for city councils, there have been a couple of recounts, actually, and it's always amazing to me, and it must be disheartening in terms of people who are voters, that every time there's a recount, the numbers change.
Well, it shows how important it is to make sure the machines are counting ballots accurately. And what recounts either do or look at a hand recount where you'll look at the ballots, or you'll run the machines a second time. And either way, we need to make sure that the ballots are counted correctly. So I would like to see audits in Michigan. They have it in many other states where we look at a random number of ballots every election to make sure they were counted accurately. It's the best way we can keep on top of being proactive in protecting our ballots.
No, we don't have hanging Chad problems. I mean, there's no punch card per se, at least not in Dearborn anyway, for Michigan, but you do have to black out that little box. So when they do recounts, do they actually physically look at it? They don't just send it through the machine. Do they physically then look at it to see if enough black got into that box to count?
That is one type of recount. There's two types. One is the machine recount, which is done automatically if there's a close election, and a hand recount costs a lot more money, takes a lot more time, but a hand recount is where you're actually looking at the ballots. Like,
and in Dearborn, there's a lot of absentee ballots coming from primarily senior citizens, and those are all done manually, have to be counted manually.
Yep, and you have to ensure also when you get an absentee ballot back that the signature on the envelope matches the voter registration signature to ensure that there's no fraud happening.
Yeah, and of course it's anonymous. I mean, the ballots, when they're counted again, you can't find out who did it, and that's right. It's good. It's a private sort of thing. It's not just pulling the curtain. But for me, I've always, right from the beginning, and I always have these weird ideas, when I started voting, though, where's my receipt that I voted for these people? As if, you know, whenever there's a transaction in our society, we usually get a receipt for what we did, you know, what we bought. And there's never, and nobody's ever going to suggest it, how they do this. But in other words, I'd want to, like, if there was a recount, go back in and somehow anonymously let them see that receipt and re-emphasize that those are the people I voted for. But that would be very confusing. I don't know how they do that. But I'm just saying is that we have... What I'm saying is the voter education issue, I think, is at core here, too. We have so many young people, college age, that are not registered, number one, and number two, even if they happen to be, they don't care about voting. They think the system is either corrupt or rigged or doesn't really matter, or they don't know anything about the people. So I think there's a real relation here and a responsibility of educational institutions, high school and college, to do something about informing people. But I mean, I don't know how, do you have any ideas about how to get more people registered and then to the polls? Like this last election, you might have easily won if more people would have voted. We only had, 42 to 45% of registered voters in Michigan even showing up.
It was a dismally low turnout in this past election, much lower than we've seen in many recent cycles. And, you know, I think what we see is because there's such frustration economically and financially here in Michigan, people have lost the sense that their vote really counts, their vote really matters. It's connection to whether someone feels empowered and whether their voice matters, whether their vote matters. And when someone's constantly, consistently being beaten down by the economy, unemployment, and all the rest, it's very difficult psychologically to connect to the idea that your vote would make a difference. And what we saw in this election were many people who candidates and others spoke with saying, you know, voters telling us, you know, I understand my vote is important and all that, but I voted 2 years ago and I'm still unemployed. So why should I come out and vote again? And I think, you know, all of us need to do a better job of communicating to citizens how a vote can be and should be, at the very least, transactional, that you should have some sort of, you should see some sort of impact or result of your vote. But we certainly see now what happens as a result of so many voters staying home on election day, so many Democratic voters in particular, as well as independents. And that is those who were elected were almost entirely of one party, which very much hurts the political competitiveness of our state.
Yeah, if all adults would be registered and if they would vote, and again, some would be more knowledgeable about the candidates and their backgrounds than others, but that could really change the outcomes. I mean, locally, we've had a couple of elections. It's a matter of 10, 15, 20 votes one way or the other. After the recount,
yeah,
it was even closer. And so everybody's vote counts. But, of course, it's that involvement every day trying to find out what's happening in politics. We always recommend at least the local papers, Dearborn Times Herald and Press and Guide, which we try to favor here. And even that, there's other ways, of course, you can get online to find out what's going on. But that sort of involvement, even Amy and Dennis, they were part of this sustainability conference we've been having in Dearborn, organized by Sierra Club Cool Cities. This last Wednesday was the fourth one. And there's political consequences to all the issues brought up there about global warming. And well, if you got to bring about change, then you have to consider the political system and get some laws renewed, reviewed, or new ones in place, of course. I was interested when you mentioned, oh, I have to say, just again, personally, can they just change the day of the week, or is that a federal government thing? Why does it have to be Tuesday?
It does have to be, yeah. There's actually a movement called the Why Tuesday movement. Anyone can Google that to sort of see about the plans to change it. But it was set at a time in the 1800s when only male landowners had the legal right to vote. And those farmers, when they did their harvest, their weekend was actually Tuesday. Their day off was Tuesday. And so it made sense back then to have it on a Tuesday. But now, of course, times have changed, and many states, Louisiana, a few others, have their state elections on a Saturday. Other states like New Jersey have made Election Day a holiday so that most people have the day off on Tuesday.
So we have some state initiatives we could put in place. I just know that in terms of national elections, I think it's Australia, New Zealand. They do it, is it on Sunday or Saturday? And they have like 90% voter turnout.
Well, they also 90%. Mandate, require that everyone's registered to vote in Australia.
All right.
It's compulsory voting. And there's lots of different reforms structurally, as well as early voting, which enable people to vote on a Saturday, Sunday, or Monday before Election Day. I would have implemented that. And as Secretary of State, it's something that I think is very critical. So there's lots of reforms, but the bottom line is, even where we see these reforms in place, people still don't vote in large numbers, and as a result, you have a very slim number of people making decisions for everyone else.
I have friends that are in Texas, and it looks like the studies just reports came in after the last couple of years. They could do early voting as early as a month, not absentee. They just go vote, no necessary reason, and that's sort of reduce the number of people that show up for the election as a whole. It's like the excitement of building to that day sort of gets the bandwagon effect. More people go to the polls. Everybody reminds one another, hey, it's election day. Hey, you want to go vote? And we go to lunch after or whatever, you know, and it's very hard on the campaigners. They don't know, even in Dearborn, when the absentee ballots go out, because there's so many, should they send two mailings that doubles the cost of their election, one to the people who are going to vote early and then one for the people that are waiting until later. And if it's all spread out, well, who knows what they do with their campaign money, which is mainly direct mail for local elections here. So some of these reforms, just because it's a reform doesn't mean it's really going to work or be successful. I just really feel badly that young people, and you know, it's going to be their country in 20, 30 years, and how it's getting messed up now may be a big consequence to them. They should get involved and start voting whatever's appropriate as early as they can. It's about time, but one last question here, because I was amazed that you just, is there anything the state of Michigan can do about media access for candidates and the cost of campaigning? You know, it seems like only the rich people or the people that are very lucky with massive donations, like Republicans, are the ones that get their name out there, their 30-second spots. And of course, as a media professor, 30-second spots can't tell the people really much that should matter. They should, and a lot of professors in telecom across the country would like to see that banned, but that would be too radical. I mean,
First Amendment.
The people that get elected now, too, they were dependent on that situation. Mm. So if you change that, oh. So is there, because you mentioned, is there anything we might be able to do to change that, the power of money in politics or the unfairness of campaign elections?
Well, unfortunately, there was a Supreme Court decision in January that said corporations can now take their profits and use that money to pay for attack ads. And that's why we saw so many more ads than we've ever seen before in this recent cycle, because companies now have a legal right to buy an ad to affect a campaign. The only way, and they also don't have to tell anyone, they don't have to disclose when they're paying money to affect an election. So the number one reform we need most immediately is a requirement that those companies disclose when they're putting those ads on TV, in the hope that that would help regulate those companies. But beyond that, we need public financing is certainly an option that's in place in other places. There's always a question of where the public money would come from. Free airtime is something that a lot of stations gave.